Hi, everyone. I'm Terry Hutchinson. Welcome to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. My co-host today is my regular friend, Mark Johnson, and our discussion topic is going to be a survey of Moses material for our listeners as we get ready to study Moses for the Come Follow Me in the next couple of months. Now, the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. If you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Cast, or any other podcast app. And because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Terry. It's glad to be talking to you again.
You've written on Moses for the Interpreter Foundation, and we've talked a little
about
that before.
We have. It was a bunch of years ago, a couple of years ago, it feels like.
A couple years ago.
But yeah, talked about particularly Moses chapter 1 in the book of Moses as a product of antiquity and what that would look like.
When you were doing that, you looked up the scriptures, of course.
Uh-huh.
And you took elements of the scriptures, but you also looked at other sources. Tell us about a little bit about that. So let me set the preface for this. As I was preparing for the program, I thought most of our listeners are knowledgeable about the scriptures, including the Old Testament. Now, there may be a few who maybe haven't read it very often or very much, but most have. So the question is, what other materials are there out there to help us better understand Moses and the children of Israel and everything that was going on? Because this is central to Judaism, and I would argue Christianity, as well as Islam. And some other time, we're going to have Dan Peterson on, and we're going to talk more about Islam, especially with what's been going on in the Middle East during the periods of time we're recording these. But for right now, what do you feel are some of the materials that Latter-day Saints can access? I can tell you that one of them that's available in Deseret Book, I mean, there's a few in Deseret Book, and it's called From Creation to Sinai. And it's the Religious Studies Center. I think they're going to do 4 volumes of it, one that comes out every 4 years. But 4 years ago, they put this out, and there were a lot of essays about it, especially the last section that talked about Moses and the law of Moses. So that's, I think, a good place to start, because the scholars who wrote in that book, and John Gee's one of them, have heavily footnoted their material. And they use material from scholars all over the world who have spent their lives studying this period of the Bible and this scripture, if you will. And they've come to some conclusions. And I found that a lot of them are very helpful in my own personal research. And you're one of those who read the book that I wrote with my father-in-law, The Temple Pathway to Heaven. Uh-huh. And frankly, I would recommend you buy that book and look at the footnotes, because the footnotes are a very thorough survey of a lot of the modern scholarship on all kinds of these issues. But that's just a personal plug. I mean, I try not to do that too often here. But
that's fair. Yeah,
and honestly, go ahead.
I was just going to say, honestly, we're both the kind of students and scholars who probably love going through the footnotes a lot more than maybe normal people would.
Are you saying we're not normal? Wait, strike that. We're on a podcast.
Yes.
About a survey of Moses literature. Okay. And we're both excited about it and enjoying ourselves. We're not normal.
No, that's just, I mean, if we were talking about Isaiah, then it might be even more beyond normal.
I'm happy to dig into the footnotes of Isaiah, though, and you probably are too.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is, Moses has fascinated me ever since I was a boy. I remember my grandfather had some books, and eventually I inherited them when he passed away about 30 years ago. And I remember reading the first 2,000 years and the 3,000 years.
Oh, yes.
And the 4,000 years by Cleon Skousen. And that was really my first introduction to, let's just say, biblical commentaries. And while they were very limited compared to what we have now and what I've read as an adult, in my very young teenage brain, they were just awesome.
Yeah.
And especially the pictures from the movie The Ten Commandments that illustrated that third volume, that 3,000
years. No, and that's all right.
When
that's
I funny. Picture Moses, I I have to confess, I have a visceral response to him as Charlton Heston. I just picture him. Or as Michelangelo's Moses. So, okay, so what do you think is someplace to start? I've started with an LDS author, a group of LDS authors, or collection of essays I think people can start with.
My go-to is, it's a big coffee table size book called Jehovah and the World of the Old Testament. It has been authored by and compiled by Richard Neitzel Holzapfel. Am I saying that right?
Probably not. I think, yeah.
Okay. Dana M. Pike and David Rolf Seeley. All three of them have degrees in ancient biblical studies, and they all teach down at BYU. I believe they're still teaching.
Well, Donald Perry and Dana Pike both were on the Dead Sea Scrolls team.
Yes, true.
So they are top scholars in their field for sure. And that's that is a great book if you can find it. It's too bad Deseret Book let it go out of print, but you should hunt one down if you can. And it's a companion to Jesus Christ in the World of the New Testament that was written, very, very similar book. Both of those are excellent.
Yeah, very good. Good, solid books, lavishly illustrated. Mm-hmm. Very deep stuff in there. They have to gloss over things because you're covering the whole Old Testament in one book, but they do a pretty good job about immersing you in the culture.
There's several things that are done by the Interpreter Foundation. There's some journal articles we'll be talking about. But one of the things the foundation does is a Temple on Mount Zion series that they have about once every 2 years. And then afterwards, the books are collected into collections of essays, and those are really good. And there's a couple that I would highly recommend that deal specifically with Moses or portions of the Old Testament. So one of them is in volume 4. It's called Sacred Time, Sacred Space, and Sacred Meaning. And the article is by Matt Bowen, Where I Will Meet You, The Convergence of Sacred Time and Sacred Space as the Ideological Function of the Tent of Meeting. To simplify that, it is essentially talking about how the tabernacle itself is a convergence of sacred time and sacred space so that God can dwell there. I believe this article has been reprinted, but what a lot of people don't realize is that many of the chapters from previous interpreter books are eventually released for free, and those, I think, usually come out on Tuesdays. They're warehoused in the journal section on the website. So you can look up Matt Bowen and find this article. And I would just encourage you to read what Matt has to say, but also look at his footnotes, because the footnotes of any of these articles, just as in the books that Mark and I have talked about so far, are going to lead you in a direction about anything you're going to want to study with regard to Moses, with regard to his life, with regard to the children of Israel or the wilderness. Here's another example from the third volume, which is called The Temple Ancient and Restored. There's an article on page 273 called Experiencing the Presence of the Lord, The Temple Program of Leviticus, and it's by John W. Welch. And I will tell you, this was a fantastic article, and you can find that on the website. It really paints a picture of Leviticus in a way that the general reader is going to say, wow, I never thought of Leviticus in this way, as really a temple text, literally a temple text, by virtue of the covenants that it talks about, by virtue of the sacrifices. And where everybody typically views it as being very dry and dull, it really comes alive in this article. So that'd be another one I would suggest. Mark?
Yeah, that one is really good. There was another interpreter article you can look up by John Gee. This was also in one of the Temple on Mount Zion conferences. This was from 2018. This one is called Put Off Thy Shoes From Off Thy Feet. It talks about sandals and sacred space. And he goes over some of the practices of the ancient Egyptian religion about, you know, taking off your sandals as you're entering sacred space there in Egypt, in their temples and their shrines. And he, you know, correctly brings that in comparison with Moses and his experience on Mount Sinai. So provides some good backgrounds there to the cultural beliefs and habits of the ancient Near East. You know, what Moses' neighbors were doing and his Moses' former people were doing.
So when you wrote about Moses, you're talking about the Pearl of Great Price Moses won.
Yes.
But when you read about Moses, when he's a baby, when he's born, what are some of the materials that come to mind for you when you're looking to deepen your understanding?
There's a lot out there. A lot of the stuff we can get from the scriptures itself. We find teachings about Moses, particularly from the New Testament. Book of Mormon talks about him. We learn about him in the Doctrine and Covenants as well. Talks about where he, you know, and how he received his priesthood. He's also in a lot of pseudepigraphical works. He's featured in sources like the Book of Jubilees. He's also in other works such as the Assumption of Moses. I believe there's a Testament of Moses as well. All of these kind of expansions on the biblical text where the author, for instance, going back to the Book of Jubilees, the author of that reworks the biblical story starting with Moses on the mountain about to receive the law. And the author reworks that story and expands on it to present additional themes about his own theology and his own version of, you know, the religion of Israel, and kind of gives himself away through some of these additions and motives. But there's a lot of things that are in these works that have ancient parallels with other pseudepigraphical and other biblical works too. So it's an interesting way to study by going over these parabiblical writings.
Study of the Book of Jubilees is a fascinating example, because what it does for those listeners who might not be familiar with it, it's actually a work that came to public knowledge after Joseph Smith died. Now, why that's important is because the Book of Jubilees is the first pseudepigraphal work that has Adam and Eve making sacrifices when they get out of the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they did sacrifices in the Garden of Eden. So the Book of Jubilees is essentially all of the Book of Genesis and part of the Book of Exodus written as if Adam and Eve and all of the patriarchs and prophets in Genesis followed the law of Moses. So the sacrifice that Noah makes when he gets off the ark is a sacrifice under the law of Moses. This is a version of what people call rewritten scripture. I intend on this program to explore this further with other scholars, but the idea of rewritten scripture is to take the scriptural stories and rewrite them based upon whatever your agenda happens to be. I'm not saying that there are bad motives for that. There can be, but I believe that the vast majority of them were done in good faith in order to make certain points. Other examples of rewritten scripture would be Josephus, when he's telling some of these scriptural stories. Pseudophilo, who is something that's abbreviated as L-A-B. These are examples where either the translators or the authors have taken liberties with the material, if you will. And that wasn't something that was frowned on in the ancient world like it is today.
Even the chronicler.
Completely different agenda than the Book of Kings.
Exactly.
And you know, so when you
covers the same timeline and same stories, but you know, he tells them differently to, you know, get a different point across.
A different perspective. And the Kings come across a little better in the Book of Chronicles than they do in the Book of Kings. And I think part of that's because the Deuteronomists had a bit of an agenda. And Kevin Christensen and I talked about that in our last podcast a couple of weeks ago. But these are all kind of general materials. You can get them. I recommend that you don't go to some of the older sources, like the translations from R.H. Charles. James Vanderkam, one of the world's leading scholars on the Book of Jubilees, the Book of Enoch, and the Dead Sea Scrolls, wrote a biography of R.H. Charles. We had him on this program, Mark, if you remember, a few years ago, to talk about that biography. His work is good, but there's a lot more current work, I think, that is very accessible to people, whether it's the editions by James Charlesworth or any other modern translation. There's a series of volumes with some of these works put out in what's called the Annotated Series. They're very nicely bound. You can get them at places like Deseret Book. They're very expensive. They look beautiful on the shelves. But frankly, when you go to the insides, you can do a lot better in other places for a lot less money. There's a translation of the Book of Jubilees that's readily available from the Hermeneia series. Now, you don't need to buy the two-volume commentary written by James Vanderkam, but I do recommend the paperback translation of it. When it comes to rewritten scriptures, let me give you another example. One of the stories that Mark and I find most fascinating about Moses is his experience on Mount Sinai. where he brings the tablets down after being up with the Lord. And then he sees the people who are worshiping the golden calf, and he destroys the tablets. And then he goes back up and gets a new set of tablets, but it's different. In some reports, one of them being the Joseph Smith translation. And frankly, the Joseph Smith translation is a little bit of an example of this rewritten scripture genre that we were talking about. I hesitate to say that about the inspired revisions that Joseph Smith wrote, but he specifically refers to this in a different way. Mark, do you want to tell us about that?
So all of this happened on Mount Sinai. Moses receives the law. He brings it down, and then he finds that the Israelites, under the direction of Moses' brother Aaron, had built this golden calf, this idol, and Moses throws down the tablets, breaks them, and when he comes back with a second set of tablets, they are different. The original tablets had the higher law on them, and said that he was going to restore the higher priesthood and the higher covenants among the people because of the golden calf. That didn't happen, so the people got the lesser law. You know, the JST additions to Exodus talk about that quite clearly.
So what do you think about that? Because there's a scholarly debate about whether the second set of tablets was identical to the first. Now, Joseph's example is pretty clear.
Right.
I believe that. I follow it. And surprisingly, Joseph Smith is not alone. There was a series of conferences held in Finland for several years. And originally, this series was called Studies in Rewritten Bible. Eventually, they changed it to still have the same initials, but they didn't call it the Studies in Rewritten Bible. They called it Studies in Reception of the Bible. In conjunction with Eisenbrons, who's out of Penn State, they have these paperback collections of essays that are just fascinating. The third volume was published in 2010, and in one of the essays, it's written by Pekka Lindqvist, and it's called The Rewritten Broken Tablets. And it's how various examples of either commentaries or rewritten versions of this scripture treat this. And early on in the footnote, he says this: there's a two-part episode involves a complex of difficult questions, both for the ancient reader and for the modern scholarship. Some of the questions concur, others are contradictory. Much of the interest of a modern scholar in particular is focused on the relationship between the second tablets and the originals, or in general on the mutual relationship of the two parallel tablets of the law accounts. But the footnote is fascinating. And this is where, Mark, I wanted to get your comment on it. While the biblical account reports that the second tablets were hewn by a human hand, unlike the first, which were made by God himself, their contents, according to the biblical testimony, should be identical. As it is said, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets, which you broke. That's Exodus 34 and 1. Why then do we find different laws in this chapter, as if the content had been altered from the original content of the Sinaitic covenant? Do the second tablets, after all, contain a different set of laws? The answer of a modern exegete understandably differs from that of an ancient interpreter. The renewal of the covenant, which we now find in chapter 34, has been interpreted in light of the source theory by most modern scholars since Wellhausen. I'll skip some of this. Parallel to that in chapter 20, the renewal aspect in chapter 34 explicitly in verses 1, 4, and 28b would then only be a redactional finishing touch to two distinct narratives in order to render the account coherent. Moreover, in the disturbing ambiguity concerning which text was in fact written on the tablets and by whom, that these words, in verse 27, the content of which is unclear, being written by Moses or merely the Decalogue, perhaps engraved by God, modern scholars have recourse to a search for several layers of redactional activity. The ancient Midrashist turns to another type of close reading, while for him the outcome of the episode is clear. And the new tablets mean a new beginning after the fall. He still faces the same question, what exactly are the new tablets? They should contain the same words, but due to tensions in the story and probably the centrality of the theme, compel the early exegete to scrutinize diligently the plot of this account. There's a much longer thing. And then in the second volume of this, and I recommend this volume, it's by Pekka Lindqvist himself, the author of this article, a book-length expansion on this very topic. And it's called Sin at Sinai, Early Judaism Encounters Exodus 32, published by Eisenbrons in paperback 2008. Now, these paperbacks are not super expensive. They're not cheap. But that's just a fascinating area where I think Latter-day Saints would be interested in what they have to say, what the findings are, and how they parallel with what Joseph Smith received in the translation of that.
That is quite interesting. I think the Midrashic analysis is something I haven't heard before. So that's something I'll have to look at. But it does seem to fit this notion that there's, you know, we're two different things on the tablets.
There's so much in Moses' life, Mark, that we can take from this. And that's why I love, and I wish we could spend more time on the Old Testament in our Come Follow Me study, because there's just so much here. We've only scratched the surface of the golden calf, the tablet, and then when Moses brought them down, there's another experience that's reported both in the Bible and outside the Bible in greater detail. Tell us about that.
The translation of the word that he used for shining face, the phrase for shining, also can be rendered as horns. So there are a lot of artwork that depicts Moses as having horns as he comes back down off the mountain. Look at, like, the Book of Mormon is an example. This is something that our friend Bruce Webster has talked about on times where when we see things in the Old Testament that might look a little weird, you know, like people with horns, if you want to translate it that way, or talking donkeys or what have you. Yeah. He says, just look to the Book of Mormon and see if that kind of thing would be replicated there. Nephi, when he was filled with the power of God and was about to shock his brothers, he said, you know, he kind of had that same experience where his flesh was consumed with the spirit. But if you ever do run across any images or paintings or, you know, translations that talk about the horns, you'll know.
Yeah.
You know what was going on.
That's right. Are there any other things about Moses' life, events in Moses' life, where you go kind of outside before we tackle some of the other themes that I want to bring up, especially from some of the interpreter articles and presentations that have been made?
It talks about how early on in his life, how he killed an Egyptian who was beating a Hebrew to death, stepped in and saved this Hebrew man. That was a really interesting episode because it shows Moses choosing, you know, his direction for life. He decided to align himself with the Hebrews there and not with the Egyptians. And he had to spend 40 years out with the Midianites.
He lived to be 120 and then he was translated. Well, mm-hmm. And that translation is another thing, because in the book that I was talking about earlier, I wrote with my father-in-law, we were going through Richard Bauckham's Fate of the Dead. And also a couple of other articles by Bauckham, who's a famed New Testament scholar out of the University of St. Andrews. And he talked about how there were Jewish traditions about Moses and Elijah perhaps being the prophets that came back at the end, or Moses and Enoch, or Enoch and Elijah. But there were really those three. And you'll note that while Deuteronomy talks about Moses died, that didn't really take with most of the people. Most of the people thought, just like we believe through the revelations of restoration prophets, that he was translated, which is why he was involved in the Transfiguration, as well as in the Kirtland Temple.
Yeah, he and Elijah, kind of the odd couple of the Old Testament in this sense.
Well, they're and Enoch too, because he walked with God and he was not.
It's true. Oh, this was interesting. There's another place where Moses and Elijah are paired up, and that is in the last few chapters of the book of Malachi.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, they make kind of a...
With regard to that, there's a huge amount of material about the law of Moses, about the feasts, about the symbolisms. I mean, we just finished celebrating Easter and the Passover.
Yep.
And for those who are fans of The Chosen, you look at the Last Supper and they present it as a Passover feast. There's a really good article I would encourage people to look up by David Calabro called Ancient Israelite Temple Ritual Through the Telescope of Restoration Scripture. This is a man who's deep in his scholarship, but yet he understands that these things are likenesses and how they tie in with the way we understand the rituals. And I think that a lot of our listeners would appreciate that one. You'll want to get that volume 7. It's by Stephen Ricks and Jeffrey Bradshaw. It's called The Temple, Plates, Patterns, and Patriarchs. There's also another article in there called Temples Beyond Jerusalem by Stephen D. Ricks, where he talks about temples that were outside of Jerusalem, like Elephantine and like some of the other places as well. So
yeah, that was a fascinating lecture.
Yeah. You were there.
I was there.
That's right. What are some of the things that you look for when it comes to understanding the feasts or understanding the law of Moses?
That's a good question. I think as I, you know, dig into the feasts and the festivals and everything, I like to look at how it interacts and intersects with the temple.
Mm-hmm.
Because most everything takes place, you know, there at the temple or the surrounding area, or one of the courts, you know, the courts of the temple. It's all there. Mm-hmm. And just to see how these things are presented at the temple, what they have as far as the plain meaning of the surface actions, but also, you know, where does it fit in a bigger picture of temple worship? I like to look at how these festivals were expressed. I like to see and read about their echoes in the Book of Mormon, to see how King Benjamin's address might have taken place. The Day of Atonement, a presentation of the sacrificial animals, seeing these festivals at the temple and these feasts and how they all intersect with the temple, how they all will point to Christ in one way or another.
It's fascinating to see their echoes in the Book of Mormon.
Yes.
When we look at them and read them, and there's been a lot of good material pioneered by Farms and in some instances continued by the interpreter where we have that. A book that I found was fascinating, couldn't put it down, but it is hard to find, is by Daniel Stokel Ben Ezra. It's called The Impact of Yom Kippur on Early Christianity.
Hmm.
And it is all about Yom Kippur and its reception history. And one of the most interesting things that he did there is to look at what he felt was the historical celebration of Yom Kippur versus the modifications that were made in the Mishnah and in the Talmud about 600 years after Christ died, and perhaps even why. It's a really fascinating one. I know it's on reserve at BYU. It's a really interesting way to view and do a deep dive into one of those rituals in particular. Like I said, I'd go back to Jack Welch's article on Leviticus. That's a good place to start. I can tell you from a non-LDS author, about a year or two ago, Jay Sklar wrote a big commentary on Leviticus for Zondervan. And I find that to be very accessible to a person who wants to know a little more about the Hebrew and about the ritual and how things were. He writes from an evangelical perspective, certainly not a Latter-day Saint one, but even so, how those things are explained can help form a better understanding as we try and comprehend what the law of Moses was all about.
Moses he's such a fascinating historical figure because we've got so many different ways to look at him through different authors. You know, Nephi will talk about him differently than maybe the chronicler will, and he'll be portrayed differently by the author of Jubilees and on and on. But I think just as an example for us and as a type, he's such a interesting one to look at because he started off with this almost miraculous birth, raised in Egypt, got, you know, exiled. You know, we could liken that to our own, you know, coming to earth and having our own probationary state. You know, Moses also wasn't a perfect man. He wasn't able to get into the promised land, for instance, because of his getting the water at, is it Meribah? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, but well, it's dangerous to ask me about pronunciation as longtime listeners realize, but although it wasn't really his weakness. I mean,
no.
The Lord never intended to let him go to the promised land.
No.
His function was to lead them there and then leave. And I think that's evidenced by his translation.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so, you know, not perfect, but he still, you know, was accepted of God, and he still made it. You know, God still called him home. So I think that gives us hope too.
You know, there's another element about Moses that I think we as Latter-day Saints can really focus on, and that is a prophet like unto Moses.
Yes.
Who is Jesus Christ. And there's a fascinating book by Dale Allison called The New Moses, A Matthean Typology. It's been published in a few different editions, but the one I think is easiest and most accessible is by Wipf and Stock. It was published in 2013, but the book originally was written in 1993. But what it does is it's given to the subject of Moses and Mosaic allusions in the Gospel of Matthew, and just the discussion of that ever since. And that's a whole nother subject of literature, really, is to see the elements of Moses and Christ. And I believe that Noel Reynolds wrote for The Interpreter on that very topic.
He did, yeah.
And one other thing I'd mention, and that is Neil Rapley wrote an article in the journal. It's called Serpents of Fire and Brass, and it was published in 2022. And I have to tell you, the footnotes of that thing were fascinating, particularly when it came to the metallurgy of the tabernacle and its sacred symbolism. Mm. He quoted a scholar who's been published in the Harvard Theological
Review
on several occasions. And I've looked up some of those and used them and benefited from them. And I got that out of Neil's footnotes. So kudos to Neil for writing about it, but then also for providing access for somebody like me who, you know, just normally likes to dive into heavy duty footnotes at any given time.
I think that's just a fun way to stand on the shoulders of giants, isn't it?
That's right. It is.
Just dive through these footnotes and just go, oh, okay. I can see so much more now.
See that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know if I can ever do anything with it, but it certainly helps me understand, especially as I read and reread. And one of the things that Notre Dame professor Gary Anderson points out, the Lord keeps repeating how to build this, how to construct it in great detail, and repeats and repeats and repeats. And in the Bible, in particularly the Old Testament, the more something is repeated, the more we should pay attention to it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's one of the interesting things about the Exodus too. It's sort of a recreation of sorts. We've got the 10 plagues of Egypt, which Moses was witness to and part of, and those 10 plagues were almost a decreation, where the light was, they had 3 days of darkness, so the light was uncreated. The waters were polluted with blood, and those were uncreated. The animals were normally created and went two and two, you know, divided and created and kept God's commandments. It was just full of bugs and locusts and things. It was just, everything was turned on its head. So at the end of creation, man was created. At the end of the plagues, the firstborn was killed, unless you had the blood of the lamb on your lentils. So that leads us into the Exodus, where they start off with the waters being divided again through the Red Sea. It's a nod to the creation accounts. Yeah. And all of their journey through this empty wilderness, being shown milk, being fed by the manna and the quail God provides. Mm-hmm. And then it just culminates in this new creation of getting the covenant.
In the sacred space.
Exactly. Yeah, so I agree with what you're saying about these recreations and their repetitions. Mm-hmm. You know, we pay attention to those because we get them a lot and they're important.
Okay. So thank you for listening to this episode of Interpreter Insights. Thanks for being with me, Mark.
Hey, it's been a treat, Terry. Happy to talk to you anytime.
Join us again for a future edition of Interpreter Insights. This is Terry Hutchinson signing off.